visitors. I'm the pastor here. My name is Sam. And we're going to do something a little bit different here before the scripture reading. I wanted to tell you a story. It begins with a man of mild disposition. He was a minister, and this was a quiet and gentle man, very generous man, praised for many virtues. But he was quite a mild disposition, quiet man, very humble man. And this makes what actually happened in his life and the things he did very surprising, because in his own study, he came to a place of conviction about the relationship between the Christian church and the state or the government, the kingdom at the time. And this was at a time when it wasn't at all clear what that relationship should be. This man came to this conviction, and in the community of his seminary, the president died, and the fellows got together and nominated him and elected him as the new president, their new dean of that school. But this was at a time when they were in a kingdom, and the king decided that he didn't like this. He came and appointed somebody else who was known for immorality and drunkenness. Didn't seem to be a great choice for the job, but that's what the king wanted. This man, with amazing courage, defied the king and stayed in his position. The fellows rallied around him and decided that they would not obey the king's order as well. The king sent some judges, some lawyers to conduct an investigation, and then ordered this man to surrender the keys to his residence. He refused. The king, now very angry, sent an armed guard to break down his door, actually, so he could be thrown out. At this point, the whole town rallied around this man, and, you know, the locksmith refused to replace the lock on the door that was broken by the king's guard, and the cook refused to cook for the new guy. And still it went on. The king, very angry, finally showed up at the place, cursed this man to his face, and ordered him to resign. And the man, this quiet, this humble man, refused at the risk of his life, because the king at that time could very well have beheaded him and might have done that. In this case, it didn't turn out that way. In fact, the king ended up having to withdraw from what he was doing. And so began what was called the Bloodless Revolution in England, ushered in the time of William and Mary. The year was 1687. The place was Magdalen College of Oxford, at that time a sacred university, essentially a parachurch organization of the Church of England. The king was James II. And the man's name, which you probably haven't heard of, it was John Huff. John Huff went on a few years later to become the Bishop of Oxford. And he was, you know, continued to be lead an exemplary life. Alexander Pope called him, you know, a man of great virtue. He lived to 93 because it was said of his quiet conscience. So, the whole Huff clan, the Huff family, moved to America with William Penn and settled quietly in Baltimore. And for the next few centuries, nothing was heard of the Huffs until 300 years later, a grandchild was born to a descendant of the Huffs, Francis Huff. This grandchild grew up to display the same characteristics that John Huff had displayed, a mildness masking an amazing, indomitable courage. And we have a real treat today, because that descendant of John Huff is among us and has come to live with us. So would you welcome with me now this descendant of John Huff, and now I can say a true New Yorker. And by that I mean one who lives in New York. This is Marika Andriadis. Did you come down here, honey? Welcome. Do you want to say hello to the Village Church?
Hello, I love you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Come back up here. Always sitting down, this tough girl. I understand you're living. Where are you living now?
In Chelsea.
I see. Is it a permanent place?
Month to month, for a few months.
Okay. And I understand it's quite an apartment, is it?
Yes.
So is that an eat-in closet that you have?
Yes.
Terrific. Well, would you stay with me? Because I also, I just wanted to say it was because of the courageous decisions that this woman has made that I'm able to stand before you. She's reenacting a Huff life. And it's because of that, not only in the past 7 months, because she has been basically taking care of our family, those of you who have followed this story and know, but all through her Christian life, she's been making these kinds of courageous decisions that have allowed us to come here and be ministering here. So I really did want to honor her this morning. And while she's here, let's also mention that during this time, I have been taken care of. You know, you have guys that like to say, you know, I can take care of myself, you know. Well, I can't take care of myself, and I need help. And this help was provided by two members of this church. You know, I spent some time first at Tom, my cousin's apartment, but then that had to end. And there was a couple in this church that just decided to take me in and to give me a room and have served us all by doing that in such a hospitable way. They just made their place available. A number of times they kept saying to me, as long as you need it, you can have this room. They set it up for me. They gave me space. They allowed me really comfort to tend to the matters of the church that really needed tending to. And so we're all beneficiaries of what they've done. I just want you to think about what this meant. You know, just think about what it's like to have your pastor living with you. You know, after a little while, the novelty wears off. You know, you get to ask your questions, you know, where did Cain's wife come from and things like that. Then, after all those questions have been asked, there he is. You know, he's still there. And they have just been marvelous. I got to enjoy some of Angie's first home-cooked meals, and they were good. And I just want to thank God for this man. He's a deeply hospitable man, and has made a potentially very disorienting time he made a soft place for me here in the city. So we want to thank, and will you thank with me, would you come up, David and Angie Sack? Can you hold us here? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess that's it. Yeah. So here we are. I wanted to do that as an introduction, actually, to the sermon, but now we're going to have the reading of the scripture. Emma.
The reading this morning is from Ephesians chapter 5, verses 6 to 16. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things, God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them. For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light, for the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, and find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible, for it is light that makes everything visible. This is why it is said, Wake up, O sleeper. Rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. The word of the Lord.
Okay. Well, I don't like this passage. I have to say that to you. I don't like this passage. And it's important for you to hear me say that. No matter where you are, if you're a non-Christian here, and it's important for you to hear me say that as a Christian. If you're someone in this church, it's important for me to hear you say that as your pastor, that I dislike this passage. And I don't think I'm all that unusual, you know, in my opinion and my feelings about that. You know, I don't know anyone who comes to me and tells me, you know, Ephesians 5:6, my favorite passage. I love to go back there and read it. You know, and in the short list of all-time Bible favorites, or maybe a long list, you know, with Psalm 23 and 1 John 4, Ephesians 5:6 doesn't come up too often. And it's important to hear me say this, because if you read the Bible a lot and you like everything that you read, then it tells me that you've stopped reading the Bible. Somewhere along the line, you left off reading the Bible and are starting to do something else, because you're no longer allowing the Bible to do what it's meant to do. You're no longer letting the Bible be a mirror that it needs to be to you. So, what you should do, or what I want to do now this morning, is ask why. Why don't I like this passage? Because that's really the next step that you should take. Be asking the question, is it that I don't understand what's being said, or is it that it's something in me that doesn't like what's being said? Or maybe, you know, a little both. Because the Bible does turn out to be a mirror into our souls. There are two reasons I don't like this passage. And the first is, maybe you as well, I don't know how to read verse 6 without shuddering. It's saying that the wrath of God is coming. First of all, it's saying that God has wrath. And then that it's coming. It's going to happen. There's going to be this, talking about judgment coming. And I don't know anyone who can read that and really get it and understand it without shuddering. You know? And we saw last week in the passage before this that what he's referring to here are sexual sins. We talked about that. By the way, after last week, I had a father come up to me and just pounce on me after the service. Because he was indignant because for Mother's Day, you recall, I actually asked the mothers to stand so we could honor them. We clapped for all the moms. But last week, which was Father's Day, not a whisper about the dads. I hadn't said anything about the dads for Father's Day. And this man was indignant. He had wrath. And and I thought he had a point. But, you know, I thought that, you know, if I preached a sermon on Christian sex on Father's Day, that was a pretty good present for the fathers, wouldn't you say? So I think it might have come out even. But, you know, what's entirely frightening about verse 6 is that all of us partake of those transgressions he was just enumerating to one degree or another. I mean, if you were here last week, I don't think anyone passed through that sermon unscathed. I can't believe anybody was sitting there saying, hum-dee-dum-dee-dum, what a nice sermon. You know. So if these things make God angry, in which we all partake to one degree or another, and Paul is talking about this judgment day, of course, that's coming. God's wrath is coming. Then where's the out? I mean, because what we're talking about is God's perfect holiness. That's why he says he has this wrath. And it's perfect, you know. He can't tolerate evil. He can't tolerate any evil at all. And it's not like something you can kind of work out a deal about, something you can get around, you know. If you happen to be selling your house and somebody gets angry at you, you know, you might be able to sit down and say, you know, can we work something out here? Can we work around this? Can we make a deal? But if God's angry at you because of a violation of his holiness, then, you know, where do you go? You think that you can sit down and say, let's work something out here? Now, I think that there could be many people here who are thinking, well, you know, I prefer not to think of God as having wrathful anger. I mean, that solves the problem, doesn't it? I mean, it's sort of a primitive concept anyway, isn't it? I mean, maybe I do believe you, Sam, when you say, you know, that the Old Testament God is that way. Maybe I might even believe you if you say that the New Testament God is that way as well, because he is. But, you know, I feel like in this day and age, we can really move beyond that now, can't we? Now, if you're thinking that, do you have that kind of propensity to not prefer a God of wrath, not to prefer and believe in a God of wrath? Let me ask you, really, how real are you being? I mean, you say that you don't like a God who gets angry, that you don't think there could be justification, and then you turn around and justify your anger, your own anger, all day long. You know, a few weeks ago, we saw that there was such a thing as righteous anger, right? Be angry and sin not, Ephesians 4, remember? Now, maybe you've experienced situations that involved righteous anger, that called up righteous anger, indignation on your part. I mean, maybe even this week something happened. I mean, not that this might have happened to anyone here, but just to conjure up a hypothetical example, maybe you're trying to sell your house and that was built in, say, 1880, and some wing-tipped home inspector waltzes through and says to make your home, quote, safe and sound would take $200,000. 200 grand for your lovely home that has been standing tall and strong and charming for over 100 years and will probably continue to stand there in the same way long after said inspector's bones have turned to dust. Maybe you have small reason for feeling righteous indignation, righteous anger. You know, maybe there are some other situations that happened this week that started out as righteous anger before they quickly moved into unrighteous anger. Or actually, let's take something more substantial. Maybe something perhaps a little more relevant to this set of passages here. Maybe you learn about the industry of childhood prostitution, which is an industry that is global and actually affects, you know, movements of population, so that there's a flow of children from Latin America into Northern Europe, you know, and from Eastern Asia into the Middle East. And you learn about these things because, you know, in Latin America, the prostitutes most in demand are from age 10 to 14. And in Brazil, a girl of 12 can take in more money than a grown man working in a factory. So there are a lot of things that are powering this industry, and it's rampant. So in Paris, you have 5,000, estimated 5,000 boys and 3,000 girls working under the age of 18. in this way. In the red light district of Manila, of course famous for having a red light district, there's over 100,000 call girls registered there. But you might be a little bit angry to learn that there are also 20,000 children in that district, and that's an estimate, probably higher. So how's that for the good use of the gift of sex? Powered in part, you know, by pornography industry here. Now, learning about these things, do you feel anger? Do you maybe get a little bit angry? Well, now, you get angry, you're saying, and God cannot be angry? Let me tell you something. He has infinitely more justification for it. When we, each in our individual ways, screw up his gorgeous creation and with our sin and ignore his loving overtures to us. And just be real about, you know, preferring what kind of God you prefer. Are you trying to find the truth or avoid it? So that's another reason. That's one reason. This scariness of a wrath that's coming. But I don't like this passage. The other reason I don't like it is because of the way that it draws this picture between us and them. I mean, light and darkness is the metaphor that Paul takes up. I mean, it's hard to imagine a metaphor that sets up a greater dichotomy than that. I mean, what can light have to do with darkness? Right? The two are unmixable. They can't coexist. If light's there, darkness has got to go. So when it says in verse 7, don't be partners with them, you know, I don't like it. I don't like it because I'm here to build connections. I mean, we who are here in New York City have an obligation to bridge build between the ancient historic faith and the contemporary secular culture. And I want to make these connections to bring the good news to folks, to permit truth to flow. I want to show people how, because it certainly is true, that Jesus Christ answers the very questions that they ask, the very deep needs and desires that pagans have, Jesus Christ can meet. That's true, and I believe that. And in fact, in many cases, folks already believe a lot of it, and what they believe should lead them to embrace Christ. They might not realize it, but it's not a far step at all. And that's where my head's at. And I also really want the Christian church to benefit from the work and products of a non-believing culture. We have much to learn and receive from the them. We have a lot to learn and receive from them. These things are true. So consequently, I want to minimize the differences to make this two-way connection, to build this intellectual, spiritual bridge for people. One work is part of that is minimizing the differences between people of faith and people of unbelief. But this passage maximizes those differences. It digs a canyon between the us and the them. Notice that. The days are evil. So there's a danger for me in what I'm trying to do here, to forget that there is a difference, to ignore the canyon, to stop making a connection and to go make something else. But I also want to say, you know, it looks like we need to look at what Paul's saying here, because it looks like Paul could be saying, don't share with them or don't associate with them. He says, you know, NIV translates it partner. Don't be partners with them. He says, don't be symmetrical with them. That adjective means don't be one who shares in the possession of something, of partaking with another in a thing. So I'd like us to look at what those things are. Okay, that Paul is saying, don't do it. Because please note that Paul does not say that you were in darkness and now you've come to the light. You know, or now that you see the light, or now that you are walking in the light. You know, these are expressions that make for great Baptist hymns. But that's not what Paul is saying here. That's not what he says. Paul says that You are light. See? Jesus Christ is the light in verse 14, but the believers, you are light in verse 8. If you're in the Lord, you are very light of light, says Paul. This is an identity thing. The us are light, the them are darkness. Okay? I don't see, you know, how much of a break you could make more than that. You are light. Well, a part of this, getting through this, I think, is to understand what he's saying by being children of light. What does it mean to live as children of light? And verse 10 tells us what he means. It's living a life of constant examination. Okay? The word there, dokimazo, means to try, to examine, to be testing what you're doing. Constantly examining. And this is the Christian life, to try to find out what pleases God, to be asking always these questions. Is this goodness? Is this truthfulness? Is this righteousness? And it's funny, it's a little ironic, because this is precisely what turns pagans off about Christians. You know, because our life is constantly examining ourselves. Is what I'm doing pleasing God? You know? And it becomes the natural inclination of the Christian to be asking this. And to the non-believer, this just seems like you are not living life, because you're constantly asking these questions of yourself. It doesn't look like a lot of fun. So the them looks at the us and says, yuck. And why are you always asking questions like that? You need therapy. But for a Christian, what we can call it thirst for righteousness, because that's really what it is, this thirst for righteousness, it must be pursued. Because what you find out as a Christian is to do what pleases the Lord feels like who you are. When you can find out what pleases the Lord and do it, it feels like who you are. And I'm afraid I know there are people here today who might be coming to the conclusion that you don't like Christianity. You've maybe checked it out for a while and are deciding you don't like it, but you are finding yourself asking these questions of yourself. You're finding that you're starting to ask these questions. Am I being truthful here? Am I being good and kind in a way that would please the Lord? You're concerned about these questions. All I can say is sorry. It's happening to you. You're becoming a Christian. Sorry. You're going to have to go out and buy yourself one of those fish stickers for your bumper. There's not too much you can do about it at that point. So that's what Paul is getting at when he's saying children of light, live at children of light. It's all about exposure of darkness. It's not about having a self-righteous air or a sense that you are somehow better than the darkness. It's about a life of examination, an effort, a push, a motivation to expose both in ourselves and outside of ourselves. But verse 11 tells us something crucial. And it's the reason that we find for the metaphor. It's important to always, when you're dealing with a metaphor, say, what's the point of the metaphor? Why is he bringing it up? Why is he casting it in this language? And what verse 11 tells us is that what the us are supposed to do is to live in a certain way that exposes the darkness as darkness, to bring light into a situation. Christ is the light, and so in Christ we are the light to do what? Well, to shine on pagans. I mean, the point of the metaphor is to highlight a principal purpose of your life, exposure. Okay? And so he goes on in verses 13 and 14 and says, this is what our job is, to expose things, just as it used to be, to cover things up, to live this life of truthfulness. We are out there speaking honestly about ourselves as well as others, admitting things. Now, in verse 14, we find Paul is making a quotation, right? And who can tell me, I'll just ask you if you want to raise your hand, who can tell me what Bible verse he's quoting there? For all you sharp Bible people. Anyone tell me what Old Testament scripture he's quoting there? Come on, you call yourself a church. No one? Not even Amy, who usually gets these answers. Okay. Bear with me. Actually, you probably can't think of the Bible verse because it isn't a Bible verse, actually. Paul is making a quotation, but it ain't from the Bible. So what is he doing? What is he quoting? Well, he's quoting, apparently, you know, a Christian song that was popular at that time. He's quoting some hot worship music that was going on at that time, you know. Now, he gives us the words, of course. We can't tell what the tune is, but I could say it probably went something like this. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine, shine on you, oh yeah, and Christ will shine, shine on you. Because, you know, given when this letter was written, we're talking 50s music here. My wife says, we're talking really 50s music. So it's something that they used to say. And the point is, Paul is quoting this contemporary song, saying, you know, this is why we sing this. This is why it's said, because this in this popular lyric, Christ is the light shining. And that's why he's, you know, bringing it in, right? But let me ask you, to whom is the song addressed? Who are the words actually addressed to in the song? Who are the sleepers? Is it the us or the them? Well, based on what happens right before, in those verses right before, and what happens after, the people being addressed are the them. It's the them. He's talking about non-believers rising because light shines on them. We're here to wake them up. Now, just let me ask you a simple question. Simple question. To shine on them, or maybe we could put it better as, for Christ to shine through us on them, where do we need to be? Well, it must be that we need to be in their lives. We need to be associating with them to shine on them. We need to be around them. The light needs to be there alongside of the darkness. So this means that in verse 7, when he says, you know, he's talking about this non-partnership that we should have. Non-partnership doesn't mean not associating with non-believers. He can't mean that. Paul cannot be saying that the us should not spend time with the them. He can't mean that, for he clarifies this in another place when he's writing to the Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians 5:10, he says, you know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't associate with people who do wrong things. Because if I were saying that, then you would have to go completely out of this world, into outer space. So I'm not saying that, he said. Don't get the wrong impression. So he's not saying that. Then what is he saying? He's prohibiting, he tells us in verse 11, the deeds that are done that are displeasing to God. That's all, and that's only all that he means. That must be all, because if we're going to do the job that this passage is calling us to, if we are light, then we must be associating with the them. There's only one line to draw in the sand, and that's not committing wrong yourself. That's all. Now, in certain situations, I realize that, you know, some of us, especially younger believers, need to ask the question, you know, am I being drawn into deeds of darkness by my associations? You know, do I need to create some distance for my own spiritual life, my own spiritual health? And that's, you know, I recognize there's a need to do that. But if you do that, you should realize that's a remedial step. Okay, that's not the goal. And if you've been developing this idea that the point of the Christian life is to spend as much time around Christians as possible, you err. And if your ideal is to form a safe Christian enclave where all you have to do is see Christians all day, and you start arranging your life to make that happen, you're disobeying the Bible. You're just particularly disobeying this passage. Because the whole reason that Paul brings up this metaphor is to tell you that the purpose of your life, if you are the us, is them. In fact, someone else spoke like this, talked about believers being light. You know, can anyone tell me? I'll give it another chance since I took you the last time. Can anyone tell me who else calls believers light? Did you say Jesus? Jesus, right? Of course, that's always the answer. Yeah. Now, Paul's not being original here. You know, Jesus brought up this metaphor, and he brought it up to say the same thing. You are light of the world, he says. And if you go back and you read why Jesus brings that up, you'll see that Jesus brings up this metaphor for the same reason. And it's quite telling. He says that the us are there to shine, to live there for the sake of them, not to disassociate with them, but to be in their lives. Okay, that's the point of the metaphor, not to say how much better the light is than the darkness, but to say this is the point of what you're living for now. And, you know, we have plans in this church to try to act out this passage by something we're going to do in September. And we're going to try to do this to bring light into a new corner. And maybe it won't work, but we're going to try it. But this is the way it works, okay? The us must live a life of self-examination and conviction about what pleases the Lord. They just do that. It's their inclination. And as your life is lived in proximity to the them, the light shines through, however imperfectly you feel it is doing in your life. Just as Bishop Huff simply walked according to conviction and thereby changed the world, you know, your life can do the same thing. It will call attention to the fact of the darkness if you simply do that. See, the only way you can get through this passage and have everything Paul says make sense is to realize, you know, that if you're one of the us, you're here to live for them. That's why he says, take every opportunity, you know, make every opportunity. He says, be sure that you walk wisely. Why is he saying that? Why would you be taking every opportunity? Opportunity for what? Opportunity to shine on them, for the days are evil. Living on behalf of them, for them. So yes, there's an us in them, no question. But it's not an us against them. It's an us living in behalf of them. And